91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour we explore the views of journalist and editor Harriet Brown about weight loss and what she terms our obsession with weight and thinness. Hello, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Most everyone recognizes that a desire for thin bodies dominates our culture. Diet books, products, and spas rake in billions. Yet few dieters gain meaningful, long-lasting results. But Harriet Brown, a magazine journalism professor, goes much further in her weight-related criticism. She says overweight or mildly obese people are unlikely to gain better health or longer lives. We'll learn more and, of course, take calls after the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Reports are emerging that ISIS has infiltrated a Palestinian refugee camp in Damascus, Syria, reaching deeper into the heart of Syria's power base than ever before. The self-proclaimed Islamic State, or ISIS, has already carved out large portions of northern Syria and territory in neighboring Iraq as part of its caliphate. Today, the Palestinians formally become members of the International Criminal Court. NPR's Emily Harris reports from Jerusalem. Palestinian officials expect the court to look into two alleged areas of Israeli war crimes.
Palestinians want the International Criminal Court to investigate Israeli settlement building in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, as well as Israel's actions during last summer's war in Gaza. The court prosecutor opened a broad preliminary investigation in January, shortly after Palestinian officials took first membership steps. Palestinians say they are ready to offer more information if the prosecutor requests it. Israel is not a member, so not subject to any court proceedings, and Palestinian groups such as Hamas may also be investigated by the court. Emily Harris, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Closing arguments in the Boston Marathon bombing trial are now scheduled to begin next Monday. The defense rested its case yesterday in the first phase of Jahar Tsarnaev's trial. WBUR's Jack Lipyard says Tsarnaev's lawyers called witnesses, including an FBI fingerprint examiner, who were intended to show that Tsarnaev was under the influence of his older brother, Tamerlan.
FBI officials there tested more than 500 items from the scene of the blasts and were only able to recover two latent fingerprints from cardboard that was inside the pressure cooker bombs that exploded. Of those two, both of them belonged to Tamerlan Tsarnaev.
Jack Lippiarts with member station WBUR. New regulations go into effect today requiring oil producers in North Dakota to reduce the pressure of volatile gases in crude before it is shipped by rail. The rules are aimed at limiting the risk of fiery explosions if an oil train derails. But as NPR's David Shaper reports, some safety experts question whether the long-awaited rules will do much good.
Oil from the Bakken area of North Dakota also contains volatile natural gases. North Dakota's new regulations require producers to check the vapor pressure at the wellhead to make sure it is no higher than 13.7 pounds per square inch when loaded. But many safety advocates say that level is still too unstable. They note the oil in the recent fiery West Virginia derailment measured at 13.9 psi, just above the new standard. And Canadian authorities say the oil in the Lac Mégantic crash that killed 47 people measured at 9 psi. Some experts say measuring at the wellhead is a poor indicator anyway, because the vapor pressure can build inside a full tank car. David Shaper, NPR News.
Dow is down more than 100 points at 17,675. This is NPR.
From the WLRN studios at the Miami Herald, I'm Christine DiMattei. The embattled former mayor of Miami Lakes has been reinstated to his old position after a court battle. Here's reporter Lisanne Ramos about how that might affect the town.
Michael Pizzi was arrested back in August of 2013 on bribery charges and found not guilty last August. Since then, he's been trying to get back his seat as mayor. The current mayor, Wayne Slayton, won't budge. This has led to a circuit court judge ruling that Pizzi be reinstated. So what does that mean for the town government? Bob Preziosi is a management professor at NSU's Huizinga School of Business and Entrepreneurship.
For something like that to happen, it's disruptive. Now, they may be happy that he's coming back. They may be glad that he got exonerated, but that doesn't mean that it's going to be like a foot fitting into a shoe, nice and comfortable.
The circuit court ruling allows for an immediate return to office for Pizzi. The town has 30 days to file an appeal. If that happened, Slayton would continue as mayor until the appeal was settled in a higher court. The town says the government operations haven't halted in any way. They know that there's the possibility of an appeal and are waiting it out. I'm Lisanne Ramos in Miami.
Legislation aimed at revamping mental health services in Florida is moving in both chambers. The House version, which would hold providers to a new set of performance measures, passed its second committee yesterday. The bill would also open up the bidding process on state contracts to for-profit providers as opposed to nonprofit. Lorene Pagel is the chief executive officer of Starting Point Behavioral Health Care. It's the only provider of mental health services in Nassau County. She says she can't hold on to a staff because payment rates are so low.
The patient is not going to be seen as often as they need to be seen. And when you have that turnover in therapist or psychiatrist, it greatly impacts the quality of the care that that person receives. And it's like starting over for them.
A Senate companion bill has passed one committee and faces a second tomorrow. This is WLRN Miami Herald News. I'm Christine DiMattei.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Farmers Insurance, out to educate everybody about common insurance gaps that can be costly so that no one falls victim to them again. Farmers Insurance, know the gaps. Learn more at farmers.com/innercircle.
And good afternoon. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. This hour we visit with acclaimed science journalist, author, and editor Harriet Brown. She's a professor of magazine journalism at Syracuse University, and her latest book is Body of Truth, How Science, History, and Culture Drive Our Obsession with Weight and What We Can Do About It.
The amount of money spent on weight loss is staggering, some $70 billion yearly. And Harriet Brown questions how biology, psychology, media, and culture shape the ongoing obsession. She joins us now via Skype from Syracuse, New York. Welcome, Harriet.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Well, great to have you. Well, given the enormity of this weight loss industry, you say it's based on misperceptions, poor science, and exploitations of these misperceptions. So let's begin there. What are you referring to?
Well, we hold a number of beliefs sort of commonly, and that's really what my starting point was. You know, that most of us believe, for example, that carrying a few extra pounds, I put that extra in quotes, you know, will shorten your life or doom you to developing certain diseases. The research doesn't bear that out. You know, most of us believe that dieting is at best a very effective activity, and at worst, it can't hurt us. Again, the research doesn't bear that out. So those are the kinds of misconceptions I'm talking about here.
You say that the obsession with thin bodies will wane. Why? What are the indicators of that?
I don't actually believe that, so I don't think I said that.
I thought I pulled that out of your book. Perhaps I'm mistaken.
Yeah, I mean,
okay, why won't it wane?
Well, I mean, really, you're making a good point, though, in that we tend to believe now that what we find beautiful, for example, right now, thin bodies for women, has always been that way. But in fact, it has changed over time, for sure. I don't think it's going to change anytime soon for a number of reasons. One is that some of the industries that are perpetuating that unattainable thin ideal, advertising, marketing, a lot of media, I don't see them changing anytime soon. You know, if you feel good about yourself, an advertiser or a marketer doesn't have the opportunity to sell you a product, right? You have to feel like you need improvement, you're anxious about something about yourself in order to buy into whatever it is. So I think that there's a lot of commercial and economic pressure on that thin ideal to continue to be perpetuated because it's unattainable for most people. So it's like a perfect you know, thing to shoot for that can keep people engaged in the process. And that's really the main thing. And the other reason I don't think that is going to change is that historically, we have always, as a culture and as human beings, valued what is rare. So, you know, 1,000 years ago, when many people in the culture did not have enough to eat, being fat was considered a higher status condition. Being thin was, you know, meant you were malnourished like most other people. So fat was considered more beautiful, more appealing, more attractive. Today we have kind of the opposite, right? So we have an abundance of food, and we can talk about the quality of that food, but the fact remains that most people in this culture can get enough to eat on some level, and it is easier to be heavier than thinner in this culture for a variety of other reasons. And so it's the thin condition that becomes the higher status. And I don't see that changing.
You question the way that you, going back to the science, the poor science, you question the way that the scientific research on weight loss and obesity is conducted. Explain what you're challenging there.
Yeah, so when I first got interested in diving into the research on this, I had heard the statistic that probably a lot of people have heard, you know, 90 to 95% of dieters gain back the weight and then some. And I was really interested in exploring that. You know, is that true? What is going on? And as I went into the research, I noticed, just for starters, that every study I looked at was relatively short term. So they followed people, you know, let's say it was a 16-week diet intervention or a 6-month diet intervention even. You know, so they might follow people for another 6 months, maybe another year, maybe even another year and a half or two. But I could only find one study that followed anyone longer than 3 or 4 years. And when you look at that, compared with the sort of trajectory of how people regain weight, and I've experienced this myself, and I think anyone who's dieted has, you know, it's not that hard to keep weight off for a little while. What's really hard is to maintain a weight loss for 3 to 5 years. And so if you look at the data like 5 years after a diet, that's when you see that almost everyone who's gone on that diet has regained the weight, and usually then some. So there was this profound disconnect, right, between the research saying, hey, all these things work, medications work, diet works, all these things work, but that's not what real people experience. And that is one of the main reasons why, because they don't follow people for long enough. And I think that's a deliberate tactic, honestly, to come up with more positive research findings.
Are you talking about crazy fad diets now, or are you talking about people that actually have lifestyle changes and behavior modification? Aren't those more successful?
No, I'm talking about the latter. You know, I mean,
you are. Okay.
Yeah, I'm talking about if you really look at the studies, you know, at hospitals, at universities, whatever, that's what I'm talking about. And I've asked a number of researchers about it. And a couple of them said to me, oh, well, there are certainly studies that, you know, go beyond that sort of 2 to 3 year follow up. And I said, great, can you point me toward them? Maybe I didn't find them. And no one has ever pointed me toward any. So I rather think they don't exist.
Hmm. And you're not just saying that we're not all capable of being rail thin. You're saying that being overweight and mildly obese does not have consequences to your health. And what were those findings based on?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that I believe, and I think a lot of good doctors and scientists would agree with this, that health is to some extent an individual thing. So what's healthy for me might not be what's healthy for you. That said, there's sort of two ways to look at this. One way is to look at the relationship between weight, or we use BMI, body mass index. That's, mm-hmm. you know, that's the sort of commonly used measurement. So that's what I'm going to use. So if you look at the relationship between BMI and mortality, which is basically your chance of dying prematurely, we might expect that the heavier you get, the higher your risk of mortality, the higher your risk of dying. So epidemiologist Catherine Flegel at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has been looking at this, collecting the data, and analyzing it for at least the last 15 years. And in analysis after analysis, she has found a different pattern. So instead of kind of a line going upward endlessly, you know, the higher your BMI, the higher your chance of dying, she found a U-shaped curve. So your chance of dying early is highest on either end of that curve. So if you're very underweight or very obese.
But does that include older people who are sick and therefore thin on account of their illness?
She has chopped the data in every way possible. She said it doesn't change the outcome. She's left out smokers. She's left out older people. It's the same shape. And the really interesting part of that is that the lowest part of the curve, so the place where your BMI, where you're least likely to die early, falls in the part of the BMI chart we call overweight to mildly obese.
Harriet, explain the term you use in the book of intuitive eating.
So intuitive eating, not something I invented. It's been around for at least 20, 25 years as a concept. So right now the way most of us eat is more or less externally directed, right? So either we're following a diet or a meal plan, or we are cutting out carbs or gluten or sugar or, you know, whatever. Intuitive eating says, you know, that's basically doomed to fail, and that it kind of looks to the way babies eat, right? So if you've ever fed a baby, you know that when that baby is done eating, that baby turns her head and that's the end. You know, there's no, oh, I'll just keep eating because it tastes so good or because I'm bored or whatever. The baby knows. The problem is, in this culture especially, we learn so early to eat according to rules and other people's regulations that we kind of lose touch with our own sense of when we're hungry and when we're full, when we've had enough, and what kinds of foods really make us feel good in our bodies. And so intuitive eating is just really the practice of getting back to being self-regulated about eating.
This morning with my coffee, I had 3 regular-sized chocolate chip cookies. I wanted a fourth. Should I have gone ahead and eaten the fourth? Was that my intuition? Or?
No, that's not intuitive eating. Okay. because basically the fact that you're even framing it that way, you know, what's going on in your head is probably, I really shouldn't be eating these cookies, but, you know, darn, they taste so good. I'm just going to keep eating them. No, I should stop. That's not intuitive eating. Intuitive eating basically says, you know, you give yourself permission to follow your and it takes time to shift from like that kind of mindset that we all have to a more self-regulated mindset.
Okay, I feel a little better.
We're speaking with Harriet Brown. She's an award-winning science journalist, author, and associate professor of magazine journalism at Syracuse University. We're speaking about her latest book, Body of Truth. A short break. We'll be right back.
The Wolfsonian Florida International University invites you to celebrate spring with a month of music and programming throughout April. You can join the Wolfsonian FIU for performances from the FIU Miami Guitar Orchestra, the Florida Grand Opera Young Artist, the FLEA FIU Laptop and Electroacoustic Ensemble, and the FIU Jazz Guitar Ensemble. Now open late Thursday and Friday, with free admission and a tour every Friday night. Details for all programs at wolfsonian.org. Miami Country Day state-of-the-art campus can be a premier spot for summer fun. Professionals lead activities including swimming, golf, archery, drama, and much more. Space is limited. Details available at summer.miamicountryday.org. Miami Country Day School, where summer excels.
And we're back, 19 minutes past 1 o'clock. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, today's topical currents with science journalist, author, and editor Harriet Brown. We're talking about her book, Body of Truth.
And for you, our listeners, your thoughts or feelings about your body image, dieting, obesity, health. Are you comfortable with your weight, or are you a yo-yo dieter? Or have you undergone surgery for weight loss and the effects of that? You can call us 1-800-743-9576. You can speak with Harriet Brown at 1-800-743-9576 or email radio@wlrn.org.
Harriet, address the deceptive ads for weight loss products. They always make it sound so easy. And also on the internet, you keep seeing these kind of Slate magazine headlines, the five foods you should never eat and that.
Yes, well, that's very good use of SEO, you know, to get people to click on things, right? I mean, who doesn't want it to be easy, right? That's a pretty understandable human trait. We all want to find a way that's easy to fix whatever we think is wrong with us. And those deceptive ads, you know, like a lot of deceptive ads, take advantage of that. And again, they follow the same strategy that some of the more serious research does, which is, you know, they'll say 99% effective, you know, but they're only looking at a very short period of time, like the time of the actual diet. Like if you go on a liquid diet, I won't name any commercially available ones by name, but it's well known that you can lose weight rapidly on a liquid diet, but the minute you start eating food again, it comes back on.
I just want to ask you if you think that maybe the brush you're using is too broad, because don't we need to distinguish between those with eating disorders that have inherent psychological factors that might cause people to regain the weight when they're dieting, and those without eating disorders, which might be attributed to cultural or biological reasons?
The short answer to that is no. I mean, there is... The reason, well, one of the reasons, and probably the strongest reason why dieters regain weight is not psychological, it's totally biological. I mean, there's a biological imperative for your body to get back to where it was. And there are many factors that come into play with that. It's really not psychological, at least I have not found anything like that. I mean, and I'm not talking about the few people who have eating disorders, but again, eating disorders, the correlation between that and weight is sort of muddy at best. So,
what do you mean? What do you mean? That the correlation between weight and eating disorders is not a clear a clear connection?
No, not really. I mean, certainly if you have an eating disorder like anorexia, most people with anorexia are going to be thin, but not all. It is definitely possible to be fat and have anorexia.
Right.
And the same is true on the other end with binge eating disorder. You know, some people with binge eating disorder are going to be fat, but not all. So, you know, eating disorders are diagnosed more in terms of behaviors than, you know, the number on the scale.
Right.
But what we do know about sort of ordinary human biology is that, you know, our bodies defend the weight that they're at within a certain range, you know. And I think that many of us might not have too hard a time losing 5 or 10 pounds and keeping that off. And that's because it's within that range, that set point where our bodies are relatively comfortable. Where it gets a lot harder is when you're trying to go beyond that, when you're trying to maintain a weight loss of, you know, 10 or 15% of your body weight, then your body has all kinds of ways to make sure that that doesn't happen. So one thing that happens is when you take in fewer calories, your metabolism becomes more efficient. So you have to eat less to maintain the same weight. It's your body's way of saying, hey, what's going on here? You know, we need more. Okay, we're just going to do more with what we have. And so that's one reason why people who yo-yo diet, you know, lose and regain, they can wind up, you know, staying fat or gaining weight on a relatively low number of calories because their metabolism has become so distorted.
And you have, there's research that that backs that up?
Yes, I'm not just making that up, I promise.
No, I realize you're not making it up. I just wondered what kind of research. So your metabolism actually changes and it harms your metabolism, are you saying?
Right, and that's one of the reasons why one of the biggest predictors of who's going to be obese later in life is early dieting behaviors. And that's exactly why. When you diet a lot, especially when you're younger, you are, and again, this isn't going to be true for 100% of people, but for most people, you are altering your metabolism in ways that are not going to help you.
Tell me, Harriet Brown, shifting gears a little bit, How about size discrimination? Is that a more acceptable discrimination, say, in employment, than other no-nos?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are no laws protecting people from any kind of size or appearance-based discrimination, except if you live in Michigan. That's the only state that has any kind of statutes on the books. But yeah, it's absolutely acceptable to discriminate in any setting.
I mean, even socially.
Well, yes, that's absolutely true. I mean,
obviously
dating is a thing, right? Yeah.
What were your findings about the obesity epidemic? Do you think that a myth that people are getting heavier?
What the science shows is that between about 1980 and 2000, and I'm speaking about Americans now because that's really where my research focused.
Right.
We got heavier. If you look at an average, I've heard the figure the average American gained about 18 pounds, but it didn't exactly work that way. What happened is a few people got a lot heavier. So we had an increase in, like, people with BMIs over 40, let's say. And the most of the population got somewhat heavier. But that stopped, it plateaued around 2000. And by the way, we also got taller during that time. But that plateaued, and it seems to be holding steady now. And there's a number of explanations and speculation, really, about why that is, but we are not continuing to get heavier and heavier as a society.
So we're not heavier than we were in the year 2000?
Overall, no. We are not.
So what is all this talk about the obesity epidemic and the rise in type 2 diabetes and heart disease and other health-related illnesses that we generally associate with obesity, especially morbid obesity?
That's a good question. What is all that about? Now, I'm talking about, you know, weight and not type 2 diabetes now. I don't have the figures for that in front of me, and so I wouldn't want to defend a position on that. But
okay.
Certainly, we are not getting heavier. The whole word epidemic, if you think about it, is, you know, there are the sociologist Abigail Seguy at UCLA has written about this, and I think it's fascinating. She calls it a moral panic, you know, that a lot of the language that winds up being used to talk about this issue is crisis, epidemic, oh my God, the end of the world, our children are going to live shorter lives than us. None of it is based in science whatsoever. It's just a certain level of, like, anxiety-inducing words that we use that really is not supportable.
Tell us more about yourself, what you eat, and also your background. Have you had weight issues?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think I'm typical of a lot of women in this country. You know, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and I went on my first diet when I was 14. With my mother, we went to Weight Watchers together. We both lost 20 pounds, and, you know, she went on to become a Weight Watchers lecturer, which I always was amused by. And, you know, I went on to begin, like, 25 years of yo-yo dieting. You know, I would lose 20 pounds and gain back 25, and I would lose 25 and gain back 30. And all of this sort of, you know, I had a couple pregnancies, I had a depression, and I wound up on an SSRI, which, like many medications, leads to weight gain, significant weight gain for some people when they take it over the long term. So, you know, there was a moment in my life, somewhere in my early 40s, when I, you know, ended up sobbing in a therapist's office saying, you know, I hate my body, I hate myself, I'm too fat, you know, I can't go on like this, but I can't diet anymore, I don't know what to do. And the therapist said to me one sentence that was really a radical shift. She said, well, what if you were just okay with your body the way it is now? And my first reaction to that was, oh my God, are you kidding? You know, no, this body is not okay. I need to lose weight. You know, how I think most of us would feel. But that sort of began a process for me of thinking about it, of investigating it. And then that process really got accelerated when my oldest daughter developed anorexia when she was 14. So in the process of helping her recover, I began to see food differently, right? So all these foods that all my life I'd considered evil, bad, you know, the cookies, the peanut butter, the, you know, cream in your coffee.
The demon foods.
Yes, the bad, bad foods, right? Suddenly they were like helping to save her life. So that was a little mind-blowing. And then the other thing, though, that was really radicalizing for me was seeing how other people responded to her. So, like, when she was very, very sick and very, very thin, I mean, she looked, you know, really ill. There was no sense in which she really looked good to me, certainly. People would literally come up to her on the street and praise her mm-hmm. body.
Right.
And that just blew my mind. And comment after comment after comment. And once she was in recovery, she'd started to gain weight, she was getting healthier, all of that stopped. That really made me think about the ways that we see weight and health and, you know, what are we doing to ourselves?
Well, we know that our society has been obsessed with thinness forever, really, which may be a bad thing, but does that mean that being overweight or obese is the answer?
I don't think being overweight or obese is an answer, and I don't think that, you know, I don't think it's bad to be thin, in the middle, or fat. I think that the more important point is bodies come in many shapes and sizes, and we are not all going to be thin, no matter, you know, how healthy a lifestyle we eat or what our behaviors are. And so within that knowledge, I think that if we can separate weight from health, right, if we can stop measuring our health by the number on the scale, then no matter where we fall on that spectrum, we can do things that make us healthier. You know, for example, physical activity that you enjoy, I'm a huge proponent of that. I think it's great for everyone. And you can do that no matter where you fall on the weight spectrum.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Harriet Brown. She's the author of Body of Truth, How Science, History, and Culture Drive Our Obsession with Weight and What We Can Do About It. If you'd like to join in, we have some phone lines open, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Email, that's radio@WLRN.org. Tell me, Harriet, about the focus on curbing child obesity, Mrs. Obama and her programs. Is that a waste of time? But aren't our kids less active today than perhaps your and my generations?
Well, again, I think, you know, Mrs. Obama has suggested some absolutely wonderful programs and changes, you know, everything from, you know, addressing the issue of food deserts to making opportunities for kids to be more active, to, you know, community gardens. All of those are great. I think the problem is when we frame them all in the context of weight, when we say, you know, it's only successful if children lose weight. And that is that sort of conflating that we do of weight and health. The reality is that all of those things, you know, and eating nutritious, delicious food and physically exercising and all of that, getting enough sleep is good for all kids and all people. But as long as we frame it only in terms of weight, I think we have a huge, huge problem, because what that does is it leads to a lot of kids dieting or being put on diets, and that in turn leads to all sorts of negative physical and psychological effects. And, you know, we're basically setting them up for a lifetime of disordered eating, poor self-image, and ultimately obesity.
Let's take a few calls on our program. First up, Hans in Fort Lauderdale. Hi.
Hello?
Hi, Hans.
Hi. Yeah, I have a question. They say if you have fat or, you know, around your belly, that is bad for your health, it's detrimental. My question is, if you have liposuction or cool sculpting, all these methods they're using now, is that actually also a health benefit?
I don't know a lot about that, but what I do know is that when you have liposuction, for example, the fat tends to come back in another part of your body. So someone who knows more could weigh in on this, but I'm going to guess and say it's not a health benefit.
What are your thoughts on bariatric and gastric bypass surgeries?
That is a complicated question.
Okay. Your findings, whichever.
Yeah. So the findings are about half of the people who have bariatric surgery wind up, you know, successfully maintaining some kind of lower weight. high percentages, and I don't have a number on this, deal with complications, you know, ranging from annoying ones like, you know, you have to take vitamins and supplements for the rest of your life because your body can't absorb nutrients anymore, you know, to life-threatening infections, to death. So I think that the decision to have bariatric surgery is obviously, you know, a personal one, and I certainly have friends who have done it and who are glad they have done it. So I think that it's really a personal decision, but the research suggests that for most people who have it, it's not necessarily going to offer health benefits.
And let's go to another caller. This is Louisa in Fort Lauderdale. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I'd like to ask the author, Dr. Brown or Harriet Brown, how have they considered that the situation of the overweight epidemic is closely linked to the quality of food that we are consuming today? The food has been so adulterated and so overprocessed that has interfered with the intuition, intuitive eating, because we have to eat in too much sugar, too much sodium, and, you know, the food is addictive. You cannot stop when once they start eating. Have you thought about that, or they have addressed this issue in any way?
Well, there's definitely people paying attention to that, and I think it's a really important issue. You know, just as we are faced with a lot of ads showing these unattainable thin bodies, we're also bombarded with ads for foods that, like you say, we know are engineered to be addictive to us, for us. So I think that, you know, where intuitive eating can help with that is, yeah, you know, you might get a little rush of pleasure when you eat, you know, potato chips or whatever, but if you can tune into your body beyond that, you might realize that, oh, I've eaten some potato chips and now I'm done. I really don't want any more, you know, even though my mouth might want more, the rest of me doesn't. So, but I agree, that really complicates things and makes it much, much harder for us.
You know, I'm just thinking, Harriet, what you're talking about, intuitive eating and being comfortable with our bodies, no matter their shape, tuning into our own bodies and what they need, that's a big thing. that is not something that we can just say, okay, I'm going to do that. That takes time and it takes practice and it takes, you know, obviously the will to do it, but that's a big thing.
You are so right. It is a process. And I think, you know, I've been in this process for probably the last 12 years or so. And I would say I'm still in the process myself. And I'm, you know, probably more deeply into it than most people would be at this point. But, you know, you can't live in this culture and not be affected by all of those feelings and thoughts, you know, and insecurities. So I totally agree. It's a process. But I can say that being engaged in that process is, I mean, I used to cry every day about my body, and I don't do that. You know, I don't feel that way. I genuinely feel pretty good about myself most of the time. And that's a huge plus for me.
Harriet, in the book, you talk about the manipulated research statistics and also the urge for big pharmaceutical sales, but you also chastise journalists. How do they contribute?
Well, and I'm a journalist, so I'm sort of speaking to my own field here. You know, all the headlines we see all the time, right? Coffee is good for your heart. No, coffee is bad for your heart. No, fats are bad for, you know, all that stuff. And I mean, you really feel bewildered when you, you know, dive into this writing at all. And I think that journalists, you know, health journalists have an obligation to look beyond the sort of headline and to question all research. You know, all studies need to be looked at with an eye toward critical thinking and, you know, and ask the questions. Don't just, I think sadly, a lot of journalists today just take the press release that comes from the study, whatever it is, and run with that. And that's not necessarily the whole truth.
Have you jumped on the kale bandwagon?
I like kale, but I have no interest in having it for breakfast in a smoothie.
What do you think will be the next kale?
Oh, I have no idea. I try not to pay attention to food fads, really.
And we'll move along to Roxana in Miami. Hi. Roxana.
Oh, hi. Hi, yes. You know, I have four siblings, and they're all very thin. Two actually suffered from bulimia for many years. I am the only child who is actually heavy, and I suffer through their comments, you know, all my life.
You mean derogatory comments?
Certainly derogatory, or, you know, we're just trying to help you, and why would you do this, and et cetera.
Right.
And, you know, it has made for a very difficult, certainly a younger life. Now I'm obviously older, and I live on my own, and I'm sort of happy with who I am. I'm just curious, however, when I got onto the program, you had just said, and this is the body type that is least likely to die early. And I had missed what you had said, like which one, which body type.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's people in the, what we would call the overweight to mildly obese, you know, on the BMI chart, it's like 24 to like 29 or 30, right in there.
Those are the people, of all the people that are least likely to die early?
Right. That's okay. What the statistics say, yes.
You have changed my life, my relationship with my brother and sisters, and I thank you. That doesn't mean that I wouldn't like to lose some more weight. I am, my BMI is 28, but, you know, I'd like to, but I don't obsess about it at all.
Well, that's good.
That's wonderful.
I'm going to go have a Lorna Doone.
Enjoy it.
Celebrate.
Enjoy.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Roxanne.
And next up, we have John in Miami. Hi.
Hey, how you doing? And I appreciate it. I've been listening to a great show. I just wanted to know what you think about, like, other cultures and, like, maybe other across cultures. Does it have an impact? For example, I traveled out to South America where sometimes I see myself as the big fat American going over there, and I don't see the amount of, not that there's not fat people where I go, but I don't see the amount of obesity or overweightness that I see here in this country. And also vice versa, when I see people that move here from Latin America, how their bodies change in about a year or two or three, like my ex-wife, where she, when she got here, she was very thin, and in over 3 or 4 years just gained excessive amount of weight that wasn't even recognized. Didn't even recognize her when she went back to see her family. So that was my question. And also part two is the dangers of stating that, or the impact that it can have when you tell people that it's okay to be obese and like that kind of ramification.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, what you're talking about, the cross-cultural thing, is a really interesting phenomenon. And I think there's a couple of reasons for it. One is food marketing, which is probably more intense here than it is in other places. And two is our emphasis on dieting and weight loss is actually, because dieting winds up making people fatter, almost everyone fatter over the long run. I think part of what we're seeing is the result of, you know, like 20 or 30 years of emphasis on diet and weight loss at any cost. You know, we're kind of paying the price in an ironic way. And in terms of the dangers of telling people it's okay to be obese or overweight, I mean, I think that's not the message. The message here is not, what I have found is that it's really, we don't get to choose what kind of body size and shape we have, but we do get to choose what we do, our behaviors. And I think that no matter where you are on the spectrum, you know, it can only benefit you to do things that are positive, exercise and eating well. But whether you're thin or obese, you know, it's not really a choice at a certain level, or it's a choice in the sense that, you know, most people have to do pretty unhealthy things to lose and maintain a big weight loss. So
I think there's... I'm sorry, but don't people have to do unhealthy things to become obese?
Well, if by unhealthy you mean like weight cycling and yo-yo dieting, then I would say yes. I mean, look, the reality is there's people of all sizes who eat too much, who eat the wrong things, who don't exercise. You know, there's just as many thin people who are unhealthy in those ways as there are fat people. But you know, some of us, our bodies respond more enthusiastically, you know, hold on to those calories more because of our genetics or our cultural background. And others, like, you know, I'm married to a guy who can eat pretty much anything and stays the same weight, you know, and I wouldn't say his diet is particularly healthy, but, you know, he sure looks healthy. So, you know, I think we have to get away from this automatic connection between fat and unhealthy. It simply doesn't hold up all the time, just like thin and healthy doesn't hold up all the time.
Right.
And we move along to Zach in Coral Gables. Hi.
Hi there. My comment is, I guess, a two-parter. Basically, the first area is, as the previous caller mentioned, the issue of, like, what really we are eating. And I just have to say also, I agree completely with Harriet and her work. I mean, this is, for a little bit of context, my mom is an eating disorder psychologist, and my father is an internist, a doctor, and they really have opposite views on this subject. And I'm really inclined to agree more with how my mom approaches this, in that, you know, there are different bodies and they all need different things, and there really is no one answer. And so, you know, speaking to that, like the kinds of foods we're eating, if they're fat-free and sugar-free and all down the line, then they're actually depriving us of what we really need from food, which a more internal approach, I forget the exact phrase you used, but...
Intuitive eating.
Thank you, yes. Intuitive eating is kind of lets you know what you actually need from that food. That is to say... I know that my whole mom's side actually, well, the way they talk about food is they don't say, oh, you know, I could go for this. They say, you know, I really need some protein right now. And I think that has, for me, been a really great way to approach food. And my second comment really is I see this, especially as it regards women, as a form of social control, this idea of fad dieting, and especially how, also how journalism approaches it, this idea that suddenly the answer has been found. Is actually very detrimental. And basically that when we are, like with, I had a sibling who had trouble with eating disorder, and I noticed a similar thing where people feel they can comment, and at their worst, they were saying, oh, you're so beautiful, but actually they were sick. And, I mean, that in and of itself, I think, is evidence that this really is a form of social control to keep women concerned about their bodies rather than about the people around them. And really connecting with them. So thank you very much.
Yeah, okay, totally agree with you. And one of the really interesting things I found in researching this is that the times in American history when the body ideals for women have become the thinnest and sort of most restrictive are the times when women have been gaining social and economic power. So like in the early 1920s with suffrage, you know, the flapper body became popular. And in the 60s with women's lib and birth control, Twiggy was the ideal. And I think there's really some power to that idea.
Tell me, Harriet Brown, if you could describe what you illustrate in your book, and that's the famous Dr. Oz of Oprah fame appearing before a U.S. Senate committee.
Well, yeah, he was hauled up before a Senate committee and basically taken to task for saying all these things on his show that he knows are not true about, you know, green coffee beans, the miracle weight loss supplement. You know, I mean, he's a real doc. He knows better. And that's what Senator McCaskill said to him. You know, how can you say these things when you know they're not true? And he very tellingly said, well, I feel like it's important to give people hope. Like hope that there might be some miracle way for them to get thin. And if you think about that, that's really mind-boggling, because what he's saying is it's okay to lie to people and sell them, you know, a fantasy, because that fantasy is so important. I think that says a lot about our culture's, you know, attitudes toward weight.
And we move now to JD in Miami. Thanks for your patience, JD. Hi.
Yeah, how you doing? I have a question. Not actually a question, but more of like a statement. When I hear you speak, you sound very convicting in what you're talking about, which is great. But in people who are hearing your program or hearing you speak right now, they want to hear a solution. If someone hears that, you know, dieting for 2 years, and at the end of the day, in 4 years, they're going to gain the weight back. Like, it's kind of like discouraging. Like, mm-hmm. What would you say would be like an idea or some kind of method to keep them on the right path, to think that, you know, there's a long-term goal at mine and I can actually hit it, instead of saying, well, 2 years from now, I'm going to gain the weight back. Like, what is the correct way? Or if it's not lifestyle change and it's not fat dieting, then exactly what is it? What will help?
That's a really great question. And what I would say is really simple. You pursue things for health, not for weight loss. So, like, for example, let's say, you know, you want to lose weight, but really, you know, you're tired all the time, you're fatigued, you know, you don't have energy, you have trouble going up a flight of stairs. You know, you can, I would approach that and address that sort of in what we would call a weight neutral way. Don't think about it in terms of, am I going to lose weight or not? Think about it in terms of, I need to, like, build up my physical stamina, you know, and I'll feel more energetic and that kind of thing. And when people do that, when they separate weight from health, sometimes they lose weight, sometimes they don't, but their health always improves. And so I think we can focus on doing the things, incorporating things in our lives that make us feel better, instead of depriving ourselves of things all the time. That's where we get into some pretty messed up behaviors. And I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, and I just want to add something you also say is that those who were dissatisfied with their bodies, no matter their weight, were less healthy than those who were comfortable with themselves, just because of that whole psychological and mental anguish over their body image.
That's right. And I mean, it's psychological and it's also physiological, because when you're stressed and when you feel stigmatized, as fat people are in this culture, your cortisol levels go up, and cortisol, you know, is stresses your body and also makes you more prone to gaining weight, ironically. So, you know, finding a place where you feel reasonably good about yourself, where you can do things in your life that are healthy and not about weight loss, is the best gift you can give yourself. And it is a process. You know, it doesn't happen quickly.
Next caller, this is Bobby in Fort Lauderdale. Hi. Bobby.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to comment that I think we have to be very, very careful. And I understand the point that the speaker is trying to make here about, you know, not necessarily shaming people, but fat is in fact a sign of something wrong with the system. And I don't just mean, you know, a little bit, but we do have a huge obesity problem here in America. And the idea that that's not a signal of something wrong, and I know the comment was made about her husband eating whatever he wants, but I mean, that it is in fact an indicator of something wrong in the system. And the bottom line is, once again, factually, that if people eat at a caloric deficit, they will lose weight. Everyone will. And so, I mean, it's the idea that, oh, certain people can't do something about it is just factually not true.
Okay, well, Harriet?
Yeah, actually, I'm fascinated by the caller's comment that fat is a sign of something wrong in the system. Mm-hmm. And I really don't think he meant
the cultural system or the body system. I assume the
or
body.
The food that we're eating that's unhealthy.
I mean, you know, the American Medical Association wants to label obesity as a disease, but their own science people have resisted that because, you know, actually weight gain is not a sign of something wrong. It's a sign of your body is working normally, but perhaps instead of living in a time when food was scarce, you know, we live in a time when food is abundant. So that's one thing. It is absolutely not necessarily a sign of something wrong, and there's nothing to support that. And number two, you're right in saying that if we eat a caloric deficit, you can lose weight. But the problem is, especially for people who have dieted, lost, and regained, some of them have to eat such a low number of calories, you know, 500-600 calories a day. That is not sustainable by most people, you know. And so then the question becomes, is it so important to be thin that, you know, you would like to live the rest of your life starving? And I'm sorry, but myself, I'm going to say no to that. And I think a lot of people will. And so, you know, the bottom line is we can prevent a lot of these issues by developing a healthier relationship with food and our bodies in the first place and not stressing weight loss at any cost. That's what I have found.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And we go to Christy in Miami. Hello, Christy.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call. I just want to say how much I appreciate the work and the message that you're putting out there. I am going to make a statement that kind of contradicts some of the things you're saying, but overall, I think that the reasoning behind your work and getting out to people a sense of not beating themselves up, not making themselves make poor, unhealthy choices in food at the expense of just getting skinny, I think that message is extremely important. The tricky part, and this is where I agree with the caller before, is it tends to be taken by people, even though I heard you say that's not your message, the way many people will hear it is, great, I'm just going to celebrate my obesity. I'm just going to celebrate my fat. I don't need to work on my nutrition. I'm just going to make peace with my body. While making peace with the body is so, so important, nutrition really is key. And your caller before said, well, if you eat at a caloric deficit, you're going to lose weight. I would actually counter that and say a calorie is not a calorie is not a calorie. Mm-hmm. If you eat certain calories, you're going to get extreme benefits in your health, and most likely, most people will slim down. That doesn't mean that we're all going to get to this wavy, super skinny place, but the proportion of our body does move to a quote-unquote healthy place. And you yourself, the author, said, oh, well, my husband looks healthy. And then the next sentence you said was, well, we have to separate health and what we look at. And there is just a primal, natural place of health. That doesn't mean that super skinny is healthy, but there is a proportionate place, and that proportion is going to be different for everyone. And my final thing is, there's a movie called Fed Up, and it was done by a journalist, and it talked a lot about, had a lot of functional medical doctors who are putting out there that the problem might not be in the diet, the problem might be in the actual processed foods, because yes, there are many fads, but the one, and there are many conflicting journalistic reports, but the one thing that's always true is whole foods and vegetables are always beneficial. That never changes in any of the conflicting reports.
Christy, okay. We're a little short on time, but thanks for your
time. Good points, Christy. Harriet?
Yeah, I mean, I can't disagree with Christy. You know, nutrition is very important, but I think it's important for everybody. It's not just important for people who might be considered obese. And it's, you know, I've heard doctors say it's an issue for everyone in this culture. So what the specific relationship is between nutrition and weight, you know, I'm not going to totally agree with Christy. And also, we live in a culture where it's very hard to separate those things. And so I think that there's a power in saying to people, it's okay to love yourself the way you are. Because that is what encourages people to begin to make positive health changes in their lives, not saying you're terrible, you're awful, and you need to be changed.
Right. Well, it's a great message. Harriet Brown, an award-winning science journalist and author, associate professor of magazine journalism at Syracuse University, and her latest book is Body of Truth, How Science, History, and Culture Drive Our Obsession with Weight and What We Can Do About It. Thank you very much, Harriet.
And thank you for having me.
Okay. Our pleasure.
Bon appetit. And that wraps up today's program. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get to. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction from Lorenzo Ponce de Leon. Remember, we have free audio archives and downloads of programs at our website, WLRN.org. Tomorrow, Bonnie and I begin with astronaut Ron Garan. Overwhelmed by the majestic view of Earth from space, he's been inspired to see the big picture in his orbital perspective of world problems. Also, Linda Gassenheimer's Food and Dining. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.